This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
South Africans fought for racial apartheid to be recognized and criminalized at the international level. But gender apartheid has not been explicitly codified yet.
That was Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai comparing the Taliban's treatment of women and girls to apartheid, South Africa's former system of racial discrimination. Also, Zimbabwe's ruling party is angry over new visa restrictions on people accused of undermining democracy. And the DRC is preparing for presidential, legislative, and municipal elections in 2 weeks. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start without stop. Top story. Today, the United Nations Humanitarian Aid Office says for the past 3 days, fighting and road closures by Israeli forces have limited aid distribution into the Gaza Strip to the area along the border with Egypt. The UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk today called the situation in Gaza catastrophic. Speaking in Geneva, Turk said the international community must demand with one voice an immediate ceasefire in the Israeli-Hamas war. His comments come as Israel widens its offensive in southern Gaza, which has displaced tens of thousands more Palestinians and worsened the territory's dire humanitarian conditions. Hamas militants took about 240 Israelis and foreign nationals hostage on October 7th when they attacked communities in southern Israel. About 1,200 Israelis died in those attacks. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says more than 16,000 Gaza residents have died in the Israeli military response. In addition to mounting international pressure over the war in Gaza, Israel's government is facing domestic anger. Families of Israelis held hostage in Gaza demanded more government action to free their relatives. Some freed hostages say the Israeli military operations in the territory put their lives in danger. The Israeli-Hamas war is taking a toll on families from both sides. Shai Wankhart is an Israeli who spoke to VOA's Esther Gituart about his 22-year-old son who was taken hostage by Hamas on October 7th. He talks about his son's battle with colitis disease and the impact this has had on his family.
Since the 7th of October, we don't know about Omer. Omer has a colitis disease. It's a chronic disease of the stomach, and it's very... It's getting severe when he's in a stress situation, like I believe he is. And it's a stomach ache, and it's going to the toilet several of times every day. I don't know if he has this condition over there when he has. And I'm very worried about him. I don't think he's getting any medicine or any medical aid. So this is a situation that you can't imagine. You can't imagine even.
What do you hear from the Israeli authorities regarding those that are still held hostage? Are you able to know where he might be?
I didn't get any informed where Omer is staying. I don't know. I have no clue. I have only a video from the 7th of October, a video and a photo that Omer was kidnapped alive. In the photo, we can see that he's not wounded, only scratched. In the video, we can see they are beating him, and he's probably inside Gaza. Not probably, he's inside Gaza. We have also informed from the Israel officer IDF that Omer was kidnapped by the Hamas. So I don't know where he is. I don't... if anyone has information, I think they should give me, but I don't think they have enough information. I'm worried about Omer. I miss him a lot. I didn't see him 60 days. It's horrible to think about it.
Tell me whether you have other children and how your wife has been holding up since your son was taken hostage.
Yeah, I have two more children. Omer is the oldest. I have Ran is 18, and I have Maya, sister, she is 13 years old. My wife is a very powerful wife. It's very difficult to handle like this, but she is doing everything, and we are doing everything with a lot of strength, a lot of power, and we believe Omer is coming back.
What kind of help are you getting in terms of counseling for those of you who have their children or their family members taken hostage?
For the community, we have a big family that support us a lot. We have many friends, and we have the community of Gedera that are supporting us every time, every day. We have also support from the government, from the IDF. We have an officer that is connecting with us.
If you had a message, you know, what would be your message to those holding Israeli hostages in Gaza?
To the holding, you mean the Hamas, probably. My son is a civilian, innocent boy that only went to a fest, and you are captive by terrorists and unbelievable and unimaginable things. Bring my son back home. You kept him alive. You need to bring him alive. Please bring Omer back.
If Omer was listening to you, what would you say to him?
I will say it in Hebrew, but Omer, stay strong. We are strong. We are doing everything that we can to take you out. And believe us, everyone is waiting for you. All the country is waiting for you.
Given that this war has created a lot of wounds from different sides and even around the world, what would be your message to the people of the world?
A message to the people of the world. On 7th of October, there is a brutally terrorism attack by the Hamas. It happened in Israel. It could be happen anywhere in the world.
That was Shai Wonkart, an Israeli whose son was taken hostage by Hamas, speaking with my colleague Esther Kitui Ewart. The two remaining members of the West Africa's G5 Sahel Alliance say they are ready to dissolve the anti-extremist groupings after the other three founding countries left. The G5 Sahel, which included Mauritania, Chad, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, was created in 2014 with an extreme anti-extremist force added in 2017, backed by France. On Saturday, Burkina Faso and Niger said they were withdrawing from the alliance. Mali's junta said it was quitting in 2022. In a statement, Chad and Mauritania say they take note and respect the sovereign decision of Burkina Faso and Niger to leave the alliance, following in the footsteps of Mali. According to the French news agency AFP, the statement says they will implement all necessary measures in accordance with the G5 founding convention, notably Article 20, they said. The article says that the alliance can be dissolved at the request of at least three member states. The joint military force has achieved only meager results on the ground. Few joint G5 operations have actually been carried out, and the security situation has continued to deteriorate. On a visit to Cameroon Wednesday, Gabon's military leader pleaded with Central African states to lift economic sanctions on his country before the 2025 elections. But analysts and Gabon's opposition say reforms and construction projects before a return to constitutional order is impossible and looks like a ploy to hang on to power. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Gabon's military leader, General Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema, says his visit to Cameroon is to discuss with Cameroon's President Paul Biya a possible end to economic sanctions imposed on his country by the Six Nation Central African Economic and Monetary Community, or CEMAC. When Nguema ousted President Ali Bongo Ondimba in a bloodless coup on August 30, CEMAC condemned the unconstitutional power shift and suspended Gabon.
Ce qui nous a amené à le faire.
Nguema says he discussed with Biya the possibility of lifting economic sanctions before he transfers power to constitutional rule in October 2025. He says he took power to save Gabon from a long rule that ruined the country and made sure that order is brought back to Gabon before handing power to civilians. Nguema's visit to Cameroon on Wednesday ended a tour that has also taken him to Chad, the Central African Republic, Equatorial Guinea, and the Republic of Congo since he seized power in August. Jean-René Oba, an international affairs lecturer at Omar Bongo University in Gabon, says Nguema has been able to convince Central African leaders that a military coup was necessary to save Gabon from the Bongo family's very long and autocratic rule that impoverished civilians and created political and ethnic tensions.
The president of the transition, Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema, is totally mindful of the reality that there's no single country on earth that can live in its own bubble in the 21st century. So he started a campaign explaining the legitimacy of the action he took on behalf of the Gabonese people. And I think the argument that he's been making are very powerful, and that's why we could see he's so welcomed and understood.
Nguema told several hundred Gabon citizens in Yaoundé that he seized power to improve living conditions in their oil-producing nation because its citizens remained poor during the 56-year reign of Ali Bongo Ondimba and his father Omar Bongo Ondimba. Gabon's military ruler reiterated that he would hold elections in August 2025. He said a new constitution that is being prepared would be presented to all citizens in October 2024, and a referendum on its adoption would be held that same year. Before the elections, Gabon's military junta says it will fight corruption, accelerate economic reforms, ensure sustainable economic development, restore stability, and revise the electoral code. George Mbaga is the president of Gabon's Network of Free Society Organizations for Good Governance. He says Nguema's insistence on executing so many projects looks like a plan to hold on to power. Mbaga says Nguema should give priority to Gabon's supreme interest, which as of now is the quest for a return to constitutional order. He says Nguema should make sure Gabon has a constitution which grants and limits powers of government officials and paves the way for democratic, credible, fair and transparent elections that meet international norms and standards. Nguema said he will keep his pledge to hand over power to civilians and that he will never betray the confidence entrusted upon him by his country's civilians, military, and a majority of political parties and civil society groups. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The U.S. government has expanded a visa restrictions policy on Ugandan and Zimbabwean officials it believes are complicit in undermining the democratic process in the East African countries. Both governments have pushed back. VOA's Carol Van Dam has more.
The new U.S. visa restrictions target unidentified officials in Uganda and Zimbabwe. In announcing the restrictions on Uganda, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said they were aimed at officials Washington sees as responsible for undermining the democratic process and repressing members of vulnerable groups, including the LGBTQI community. In May, Uganda enacted one of the world's toughest anti-gay laws. Ugandans accused of certain same-sex acts could face the death penalty. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached Uganda State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Henry Okello Oryem, who says the U.S. was looking for a reason to slap more sanctions on his country.
We knew eventually it will come to this. There's been evidence that they are looking for not only visa restrictions, but they're looking for other means of sanctioning Uganda as a whole. and making life difficult for the Uganda government.
Oriem downplayed U.S. accusations that Uganda also marginalizes other groups, including environmentalists and journalists.
One or two individual cases have made it to a mountain out of nothing.
Oriem asked why the U.S. doesn't sanction other countries with restrictive policies against LGBTQI persons.
Why isn't the law applied evenly around the world? Or such sanctions even around the world against those countries who also are oppressive, who also have issues with elections, who also have issues with LGBT groups.
Dave Peterson, Africa Director of the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, says both Uganda and Zimbabwe are doubling down on their behavior that prompted the sanctions. In Zimbabwe, he says, since the ruling party, the ZANU-PF, did not win a supermajority in recent elections and therefore couldn't change the constitution, it's looking for other ways to retain power.
Now the government has gone in and with some very contrived sort of political maneuvers tried to disqualify 11 or 12 people that had won their elections. So they have to go into these by-elections, you know, very soon. You know, ZANU-PF is scheming how they can take more seats in the legislature. And I think, you know, the sanctions are partly in response to, you know, the fact that the Zimbabwean government just will not let up in anti-democratic behavior.
VOA reports that Farai Morawiya Marapia, a ZANU-PF spokesman, has said the party is not surprised by the new restrictions. He said they show the United States is intent on encouraging the overthrow of the Harare government. Peterson says Zimbabwe's government is not all that concerned about U.S. sanctions because it does not have a lot of investment ties or close diplomatic relations with the U.S. But he says in Uganda, it's more complicated, pointing out the United States works with Uganda on regional issues and to help with peacekeeping troops in other countries such as Somalia. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. The military leaders of Mali and Niger say they will both scrap a tax agreement with France. In a joint statement, the neighboring West African nations cited France's persistent hostile attitude towards our states and what they call the unbalanced nature of these agreements, which result in a considerable loss of revenue for Mali and Niger. The tax accords with former colonial ruler France will end within 3 months, the military leaders of each country said. The French news agency AFP says the practical repercussions of the decision are not immediately clear. The French tax authorities' website state that France has had agreements with Mali since 1972 and Niger since 1965. They are aimed at avoiding or eliminating double taxation and establishing rules for mutual assistance in fiscal matters. Neighboring Burkina Faso, also military-led, denounced its tax treaty with France earlier this year. Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai has made an impassioned plea for what she calls gender apartheid to be made a crime under international law. Speaking at an event in South Africa, Yousafzai called on the world to pay attention to what's happening to girls and women under Taliban rule in Afghanistan. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani activist who survived being shot in the head when she was 15 years old by Taliban gunmen for daring to pursue an education, delivered the annual Nelson Mandela Foundation lecture in South Africa Tuesday, which this year marked a decade since the death of South Africa's first democratically elected president. The 26-year-old drew parallels between Mandela's long struggle against white minority rule and racial segregation under the apartheid regime in South Africa and the situation facing women in Afghanistan in the 2 years since the Taliban returned to power.
With Mandela's legacy in mind, I asked myself, what injustice is the world overlooking? Where are we allowing inhumanity become the status quo? The answer for me was very clear and very personal. The oppression of girls and women in Afghanistan.
Yousafzai, who won the Nobel Peace Prize aged just 17, decried the fact that other crises have drawn the world's attention away from the situation in Afghanistan, where girls are not allowed to attend secondary school and women are banned from working or even leaving the house on their own.
South Africans fought for racial apartheid to be recognized and criminalized at the international level, but gender apartheid has not been explicitly codified yet. That is why I call out every government in every country to make gender apartheid a crime against humanity.
Mandela's widow and women's rights advocate, Grasa Michel, also spoke at the event.
Let's be very precise. This thing of men thinking that they have a right over the lives of women, this thing of them believing that they have a right over the bodies of women, it has to stop now. Don't give it time.
Yousafzai said the United Nations should adopt language on gender apartheid in a new Crimes Against Humanity treaty it is drafting. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is vibrating to the rhythm of the campaign and the run-up to the election scheduled for December 20th. Candidates in the presidential, legislative, and municipal elections are working hard to gain acceptance by voters, even though they are encountering a number of difficulties, including logistical problems and violent attacks on their motorcades. A supporter of Mwazi Katumbi was recently killed as the opposition presidential candidate prepared to hold a rally. Zanim Netizaidi has the details.
As the election campaign continues for the general elections this month, several candidates are facing problems making themselves known or even getting around the country. Joël Bill is one of two female presidential candidates. She says there are problems of movement within the capital as well as within the provinces, and also problems of visibility. If you are looking for advertising, for example, there aren't any billboards left in the city because, she says, one candidate has single-handedly requisitioned 600 of them. Bile was referring to President Felix Tshisekedi and his campaign's dominance on advertising billboards. A few days ago, Moise Katumbi's political party, Ensemble pour la République, or Together for the Republic, reported that DRC authorities refused to grant overflight and landing permission to aircraft for its candidate's campaign. His motorcade was attacked last Tuesday in Kindu, the capital of Maniema province, and one of his officials was killed. But Together for the Republic spokesman Hervé Diakese says the party refuses to escalate the situation. He says they are in a position to respond, but he says for the sake of democracy and the best interests of the people, and because they know the next president of the Republic, Moise Katumbi, is leading a campaign of national reconciliation, they are refraining from behaving in ways that are not in keeping with democratic behavior. Last week, six presidential candidates threatened to lodge complaints against the president of the Electoral Commission for irregularities surrounding the electoral process and against the Minister of Interior for failing to protect candidates. However, Peter Kazadi, Minister of Interior, rejects the accusations against him. He says that opponents have the right to come and say what they see as the shortcomings of the police officers assigned to their custody, but that does not give them the right to publicly accuse the Minister of the Interior of refusing to provide them with police officers. The election campaign has now entered a new phase, with growing competition between the two main candidates, President Tshisekedi and challenger Katumbi. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Netizaidi.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Take